CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
And I'm Brian Kaufman. But first, we'd like to thank our sponsors. Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. As well, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors, whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in this week's CFO Radio News, we'll have a brief article published by CFO.com. And unfortunately, it's talking about an accounting error, that of MF Global. And the heading is MF Global's Inscrutable Accounting Error. And this is an article by Vincent Ryan. While securities dealer MF Global was melting down financially, the company finance and treasury departments, in conjunction with futures market regulators, were on the hunt for the accounting error, as it says, that wasn't. MF Global's general counsel and the CFO of its broker-dealer unit appear to have never had any evidence that faulty reporting had caused a deficit in customer-segregated accounts, but they persisted in their belief for as long as 3 days, according to a timeline of the firm's final days constructed by Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The reason why? Well, the amount was so large it was too big to be anything else, is what was said. In turn, early on, the CME and the Commodities Future Trading Commission were prevented from conducting a full audit of the customer account statements because they didn't have all the necessary documentation from MF Global. The three-day delay in confirming these shortfalls, combined with the inability of regulators to get timely information from MF Global personnel, may have contributed to the loss of $1.6 billion in customer funds and the firm's eventual demise. Well, the bankruptcy has stirred up a firestorm in the securities industry and among regulators because many of the customers who lost money were farmers and ranchers whose futures in non-speculative ways to hedge against price volatility. The firm went from reporting a $192 million quarterly loss on October 24, 2011, to filing Chapter 11 on October 31. The theory is that someone at the firm overrode internal controls that safeguarded customer funds and transferred money out of them to shore up the company's global liquidity position. Congress and federal investigators are particularly focused on the role of John Corzine, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs and governor of New Jersey, and whether he purposely directed his Treasury Department to use the customer funds. Well, these events of MF Global's final days gleaned from the CME timeline and reconstructed from the recent testimony of two of the firm's CFOs and its general counsel show a firm in chaos. MF Global was in a frantic search for liquidity as it faced margin calls from futures clearinghouses, customer demands for withdrawals, and requests from counterparties for additional collateral. Executives were also trying to negotiate the sale of a company to Interactive Brokers, a Greenwich, Connecticut-based broker-dealer and proprietary trading firm. But the sale was derailed after the search for the accounting error ended. And here's how the notion of the reporting glitch developed. The daily closing report of MF Global's customer account balance showed a deficit on Wednesday, 26th of October, says the former CFO of the North American broker-dealer unit, Christine Sawinski. But it wasn't until 1 a.m. on Monday, October 31, that Sawinski and Assistant Treasurer Edith O'Brien confirmed that the deficit was in fact real and told Mike Procagillo, a CME auditor, that such. That's because they first believed that it was the reporting that was at fault. The possibility of an accounting error was first discussed on October 29, and on that day, MF Global's Treasury Department reported to Sawinski that the previous day's accounting showed a shortfall. Well, here we have a situation, a very significant and public situation that is talking about reconciliations and incomplete reports. As of October 28th, based on the review of documents that they did receive, the CME auditors had no reason to believe the segregated account was out of compliance on October 26th. The day before MF Global's filing of Chapter 11, the CME auditors received a disc from officials containing the missing documents from October 26th, but by then the auditors were swept up in the pursuit of an accounting error. And oh my goodness, we're probably going to hear the further and future implications of MF Global as time goes by. But today we have a guest, and I'm very, very pleased to talk to Stuart Glendinning as our guest today. Stuart is the Chief Financial Officer of Molson Coors Brewing Company, very much a household family name, and I'm pleased to have Stuart joining us. Stuart Glendinning was previously the Chief Financial Officer for Molson Coors UK Limited, the UK-based subsidiary of Molson Coors Brewing Company, where he was responsible for overseeing all the finance and IT activities within the business. Before joining Molson Coors in 2005, Glendinning was Managing Director and Principal at the Hackett Group, a professional services company where he led the CFO practice. Prior to that, Glendinning worked at KPMG, and in serving a broad array of clients, he has lived and worked across Europe, Africa, North and South America. Glendinning grew up in Africa, attended the College of William and Mary in Virginia, where he obtained a BBA in accounting, and the University of Miami, where he obtained a law degree. He also served with various organizations within the U.S. Naval Reserve. Well, Stuart, this is such a pleasure to have you on the radio show. Welcome.
Lorraine, thanks very much. I appreciate you having me. I feel fantastic this week, so it was a good week to choose for this radio show.
Well, tell us a little bit about that. We're going to start into some questions that we have prepared, but what exactly are you referring to? What's going on in the world of Molson Coors?
Yeah, so Molson Coors, as you say, a household brand name, been in the beer business for hundreds of years, on Tuesday announced the $3.5 billion acquisition of StarBev, which is a similar beer business of long history that operates in Central and Eastern Europe. And anybody who's ever been to Prague certainly knows the Staro Pramen brand, which is a superb beer. And we're just very excited. Any kind of time you get through a major acquisition, the amount of work beforehand is enormous. And you take a brief respite to sort of celebrate and enjoy yourself before the real work begins of starting to integrate and operate the business. So I'm taking a day to day as a day to, you know, have a good chat with you and have a nice Easter weekend. Get ready for work on Monday.
That sounds good. Well, thank you for taking the time. So, Stuart, I'm going to start way, way, way back at the beginning.
Sure.
What was your first job, whether paid or otherwise? We've had some of our guests talking
about... Well, not
about...
counting, you know, sort of, I'm sure, the various and sundry jobs that... my parents had me doing around the place. My first job was selling car radios in a retail establishment in South Africa, and I really learned a little bit about the consumer products business there. But I learned even more about the direct connection between successful selling and making some money. So it did put me on the right path, and I learned a little bit about branding at that time.
So how did you get from the radio business to CFO of where you are today? Give us the short skip and hop.
Sure. Well, look, I mean, I had the real fortune to get the opportunity to come to the States. And one of the benefits of the way in which, both really UK or African education system is structured is that you sort of go to university and have to have an idea of what you're going to do. And so I was already lined up to become an accountant out of university. I joined KPMG, and I think being an auditor really provides people in finance a great background because in a fairly short amount of time, you get a broad exposure to a number of different companies, potentially in different industries, you know, big, small, and you come to grips, you know, with how they operate. You get the chance to interact with some of the senior people at a business. And I think those first few years in the audit practice are really developmental years, and they certainly served me well. But I did find that you know, grinding through audits at some point, you know, just wasn't as exciting as it was when I first started. And I took the opportunity to switch over to the consulting practice, which similarly had a whole new range of learning, because now instead of worrying so much about the accounting, you were worried more about the systems and the processes and the personnel structures. But I have to say, even the consulting sort of wears you out after a time because of the travel, etc. And I couldn't be happier with the move to Molson Coors. The chance to, well, first of all, I'm a huge beer drinker, so that helps. But really, being inside an organization and using some of the professional services learning to actually do what you told your clients to do, it takes a whole different set of skills. And so the learning for me has been great. These jobs are built upon one another. And I can say to anybody sort of in the professional services business, it's a lot easier to tell clients what it is to do than it is to actually do it when
yourself.
You are the client.
That's
so,
too funny.
So there you go. It's a quick synopsis.
Well, Stuart, in the CPG business, and perhaps maybe arguably in any business, you mentioned even in the radio startup that you had early in your career that you learned a little bit about branding. Companies have to have good, strong brands and good, strong people. Talk to us a little bit about that. You've mentioned the people side of business as well. Talk to us in terms of some of your philosophies along those lines.
Sure. No, that's great. I mean, look, ultimately you're in business, you need a product, and it's got to be a product that people are willing to put their hands in their pocket to pull out some money and put it on the table, and that's particularly relevant in consumer products. There are lots of alternatives when a customer goes into a store or into a restaurant or a bar, and they've got choices they can make, and they're going to make choices based on ultimately the value for money. And so it's important in a CPG business particularly to have strong brands that customers are willing to pay for. But brands don't just develop themselves. And all of the business of accounting and all the other things that go on in a business, are ultimately driven by the people in that business. And the success of the business is a direct reflection of the quality of people. And I've long since believed, and I do believe it's been an important part of my success, is I've always looked to try to find people who actually are better than I am on the theory that, they all want to move up, and so they'll sort of push you up. And
they help
and
push you to
your
success,
huh? Out
so
far. I really focus on my team first. I think it's important to have very strong people, people who have a clear view to developing their own folks, and people who ultimately have a belief in quality of leadership.
Well, that being said, Stuart, I couldn't agree with you more, and certainly over 2.5 years of our radio show, what has been a very strong recurring theme has been leaders of people, leaders as managers and as mentors, and someone who can help get the best out of the team and almost like a jigsaw puzzle fit all the unique facets of each individual to make the team collective. But you know what, in finance, we as a group of people are generally not known for sensitivity, and the importance of people really can get lost in the delivery. And I'm guessing that from your consulting background, having shared that background with you, I know a little bit about consulting is all about teams, motivation, and understanding what needs to be accomplished. Tell us, how do you get across that element of lacking of sensitivity and the importance of people in the delivery?
Good question, Lorraine. I mean, to me, I think you really have to demonstrate it, and people can see the difference in different styles of leaders. You look in an organization, and I've seen plenty of people in organizations that I've worked with, and I've probably been guilty of it of myself at times, is that sometimes you get really focused on the task, and you have to get from A to B. You've got to redo the consolidation, or there's an issue, or there's a last-minute something that has to be done. And you really tell the quality of people and the kind of leaders that they are when there's some sort of crisis, because people's real personality and leadership capability comes to the fore. If I look at folks in my own organization and their different styles, the style that's the most challenging is you get somebody in your organization who's extremely capable. They hit all their deadlines. The quality of their work is excellent, but they really trample on a whole bunch of people getting there, and other people don't like to work with them. Mm. That kind of person is, in a sense, a sort of a squandered asset, and I'm sure that many other of your listeners have run into these kinds of folks who are valuable employees who you really want to drive change. The worst employee, of course, is one who's not very capable and also tramples on people, and those sorts of folks don't last very long. As an organization, we've taken a lot of time to focus on leadership and sort of interaction training. You know, how do you interact with others? You know, for instance, I had a woman a couple of years ago came to me, and she worked for me. She really was doing a superb job, and she changed roles. And I asked her, I saw her and said, well, you know, how are things going? And she said, well, you know, I really like the job, but my operations counterpart doesn't involve me in any of the, you know, real decisions. And I said to her, well, have you actually ever gone to talk with this person and tell them how you feel and, you know, what you'd like to do? And she said, oh, no, no, you know, I couldn't do that. And I said, well, why not? And she said, because, well, he might get angry and then maybe he'll blacklist me. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, you know, I will absolutely stand behind you and I can assure you there won't be any negative consequences to this. And she went to talk to this guy. And I saw her about 3 weeks later, and I asked her how things were going. And she said it had never been better in her career. And I was struck by that because, well, first of all, the operations guy who I knew is a terrific leader. He exhibits the kinds of qualities that I'm talking about. But that small ability to communicate and interact with others really changed the course of her career. I mean, she was on the one hand ready to leave the company because she wasn't enjoying her interactions with his team. And that small bit of feedback resulted in a total change. So we've really focused on teaching people how to lead others and how to communicate with each other. And I think that's made a big difference in our business.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting as you say that, Stuart, and I'm going to make a little bit of a sidebar, but I'm sitting here thinking about a bottle of beer and all the little bubbles inside it, and almost like the people in your organization are the bubbles, and, you know, some of them rise to the top and some of them stay at the bottom, and you need both, and you need people at different levels. You need people of different kind of skill sets, but the magic is when you can open the lid and psh, it all comes out.
Yeah, that's a great visual, Lorraine. I think, honestly, it's a brilliant analogy because you're right. You are going to have some superstars. You're going to have some people who are sort of round peg, round hole. And, you know, you may have some underperformance, and, of course, you'll have to deal with those. But I think that's an excellent analogy. Certainly, I love the beer, of course.
We're all going to go home thirsty after listening to this, right? Well, I know as an organization and as a company, you're very focused on employee engagement. And one of the things that you'd said to me in prep for the show is that you feel very lucky to have world-class scores. You mentioned in terms of work environment and career development and so forth that your scores were pushing 90%. Explain to me what that is and what that means.
Yeah. So many large, well, I would say not just large organizations, but many organizations measure their general employee engagement. And employee engagement is quite simply a measure of how connected employees feel with the company, how they feel about their careers, you know, how they see the company's vision, you know, how good do they feel about working for the organization. People who feel great about working for a company do a great job. People who don't feel great generally find a way to sort of make it through the day and are more likely to leave and go and work somewhere else. And I recall about 3 years or so ago, we were sitting with our head of HR and he said, right, well, we're going to set this really aggressive goal for employee engagement. Just understand the average company has an employee engagement somewhere in the 70s. So about 25% of the people are not actively engaged. Pretty surprising number. And I said to him, wow, that's crazy. He said, well, I think we should aim for a number that's sort of about 82%. I said, 82%? That seems crazy. And I'm a finance guy. I think, boy, a minimum of less than 90% seems, you know, just unrealistic. And he said, well, you're the one who's being unrealistic because if you know anything about employee engagement, it's impossible to get to 90%. And almost nobody has that. And I said, all right. So we hashed this. We sort of knocked this around as a leadership team. And we decided that we would set a goal of 85%. Anyway, we had some outside consultants who are experts in these sorts of things, and they said, 85%, that's going to take you about sort of 5 or 7 years to get to that place. We've seen lots of companies. Anyway, to sort of shortcut the story, we ended up reaching 86% in 2 years. And so it was a pretty remarkable result. And you know, that broad organizational result reflects some highs and some lows. I would say broadly the financial team is higher and is close to 90%. So it's an enormous achievement for us. But it's not one of these things you can sort of say, right, I got to the 90% now, you know, I'll do nothing. In fact, what happens is that, you know, employees are used to this much higher focus on engagement. You can't just turn that off or you'll go right back to where you started. So every year I would say the bar gets higher. And one of the key areas, if I looked at the employee engagement, one of the most difficult areas to really manage is career development.
So, well, let's talk a little bit about that because I know you have a particular philosophy. Some leaders or managers look for very technical depth of maybe industry, somebody with just that industry experience, just that particular field of finance or accounting. And then some other managers and leaders look for breadth and look for views and creativity and exposure and experiences from the outside. Content as well as depth. So what are you looking for in terms of your team?
Yeah, great. Thanks. Look, one of the things I'm often observe is that many finance organizations have a pretty bright line. You sort of fall into one of these teams. So you're a tax person and you live and die and you stay in tax forever. You are a planning and analysis or, you know, sort of finance person. You sort of follow that track up. You're an accountant, and therefore you sort of work your way to being the controller. And it's interesting to me just how many organizations have this sort of, you know, dividing line. A lot of them, for accounting type people, you know, controllers sort of as high as they might aspire to get. And that doesn't make sense to me. I like an organization in which certainly everybody comes out of some technical and content expertise, and in any role that they're in, I expect them to master the content. But as you know, as you move up in an organization, more and more of the work gets done by others. And there's less and less that you do individually to move things, but you spend more and more time managing people. And so you simply cannot be an expert in everything. But your ability to have a broad understanding of the business, to understand the dynamics of what drives success, and to be able to manage people are much more important. And I think those skills are enhanced by people who do a broad range of jobs. And so I'll give you a for instance. A couple of years ago, we had our assistant controller. And, you know, our company drives about $7 billion of revenue, so it's a good-sized organization. And we'd moved the chap who was the assistant treasurer into a different role. And I went to the assistant controller and said, right, we'd like to put you in treasury. And he said, but I don't know anything about treasury. And I said, well, that's precisely why we want to put you in treasury, because by the time you're done, you will have managed a totally different group of people and you'll know something about treasury. And that's absolutely true. This is a guy who's had the chance to really come to grips with financing an organization, all of the treasury structures, the hedging, and he will be a much more valuable controller or perhaps CFO than he would have been had he not had that experience.
And I think
looking back, he says for him it is now night, it's night and day.
And I think also, Stuart, from a perspective of the flip side of that, you're also giving people that have skills and talent and intellect and passion to do this, you're giving them somewhat of a safety net in saying, as your manager and as a leader in the organization, I want to support you, and there needs to be a nurturing or a mentoring to be able to allow people to be cross-functional and step into a role where, from the initial outset, they may have challenges in the speed with which they have to learn lots of new, fresh areas of technical as well as operational aspects of finance and accounting, but they probably couldn't do that without a supportive manager like you.
Yeah, I thank you for that, Lorraine. I think it's a good observation. I mean, you're absolutely right. If you want to employ this kind of breadth, then you have to have some understanding that when you put people in this role, you know, there's going to be a learning period. If I had promoted somebody else from in treasury upper level, and I don't have an issue with that if you have the right person, but, you know, obviously there would not have been that learning time frame, but I think you're spot on.
Yeah, yeah. And that, I think, is somewhat of a call out to all the CFOs and CEOs that are out there listening. We hear so much of the CFOs that are on our radio that are mentors, but they just do it so innately. It's a lot similar to the analogy that I make when I say to people, how do you run a marathon? Well, you put one foot in front of the other and then you figure out 26 miles. But, you know, you very often forget to say, don't forget to breathe. And I think so many good leaders just are intuitively good mentors and good passion builders in their staff. They know how to do that. And you know, Stuart, you and I met one another, I think it was about a year and a half ago at a different speaking event where we were speaking together. And I got that sense from you. So I'd like to help by portraying some of what I think are your strong skills to those CFOs that are coming up to tomorrow. And being that CFO of tomorrow, they also need to learn within themselves the nurturing, mentoring aspect that translates to cross-functional teams, matrix management, peers, learning from other people around them.
Yeah, thanks for that, Lorraine. Look, I will say, I think over the last, since becoming a CFO, first of the BU and now the global CFO, I've learned a lot about leading others. I really understand how important it is for you know, for me to have a good team. And I you know, I always understood that before, but I think as the team gets bigger and as you move up in an organization, it gets harder and harder. And really, really having a great team and allowing that team the space to operate and develop and grow is absolutely vital, not just to the success of the organization, but to the CFO specifically.
Sure. And I think also what you're talking about is succession and succession planning. And it logically follows kind of a career development path. You've talked about having a 2+2 philosophy. What is that?
Yeah, so we set out some goals at Molson Coors to really put ourselves in a place where broadly, not just in finance, but across our organization, we had the great sort of leaders who could drive our brands. And excuse me, the philosophy of 2+2 is simple, is that for all of our managers, and we started at the most senior levels first and start to work down, that each person should have a candidate who is ready now, and that's sort of defined as somebody who would be ready within 6 months to take their role, and to a second person who would be ready within the next 2 years. And, you know, at first we said, gee, you know what, if we had all these people and they were ready now, wouldn't that create all kinds of problems in the organization? You know, wouldn't there be all these sort of people stacked up and waiting for a job? And actually, that's not true. It's not true because there are always changes going in the organization. There's always a need for succession. And frankly, it's very, very hard to achieve 2+2 uniformly. And I have very recently had a number of people who've moved around the organization and a couple who've moved out of the organization. And the succession has proved to me to be so valuable. It's great when you don't have to say, right, now I'm going to take, you know, X many months to try to find somebody, but you look, you just look to the left and you already know the person who you're going to put in that place. You will have to recruit at some point because if people leave the organization somewhere down the chain, you know, there's a need to fill a hole. But I will say that there are two distinct benefits in this for us. One is the immediacy of being able to bring a very strong person and simply slot them into the role. And two, you can't underestimate how important it is to people in the organization to see the whole organization shifting up or shifting into new roles. People see that as very exciting because it impacts them personally and gives them the chance to do something a little different.
Sure, sure. And in that regard, talent management and people management, how do you bring in the aspect of evaluation and performance management?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's critical. It's all very well to say, you know, you want 2+2, but you've got to have a very rigorous system of actually deciding whether somebody actually is qualified for taking a role in 6 months or 2 years. It's not enough in my mind that, well, I can just do the technicals of the role. We're very focused on do people have the right leadership capabilities to take on a new role, particularly in those roles, of course, that are more senior and who have that have more people below them. We have a very focused talent managing process that involves sort of just starting at the very ground level, at least one-to-one each month. That's not focused on, well, what are you working on, but is focused on the person's development, you know, the skills that they're building, the things they need to work on, those sorts of things. And then at least twice a year, on my staff, four times a year we look at people, and then twice a year we do a formal evaluation and ranking. And then, of course, you know, people actually get a written feedback from that, and that is done consistently across the organization. If I reflect back on my career in various organizations I've worked with, this has been done to a, you know, sort of a lesser, a better or worse extent. And, you know, so everybody has these structures and these forms you fill out. The question is it a form-filling exercise for you, or is it a substantive exercise? And even when I look around my organization now, this is one of the areas where I think we have the most ground to cover, because we still don't have the kind of consistency that I would like to see across the personal development plans.
You know, it's interesting you say that. And in my career, very often, certainly when I was managing large teams, you know, into the several hundreds, you might have 6, 8, 10, 12 direct reports, whatever the number is. I would always assign about a month to do performance appraisals, and for each individual, I would assign something like 2 to 3 hours per individual to do a performance appraisal. And it never shocked me each year when I came up to my staff and my managers and I said, I need your performance appraisals. And they looked at you, you know, deer in the headlights, oh, I haven't quite done it yet. I'll have it to you in 2 hours. And they might have had 8 direct reports. And they got it to me in 2 hours. But the point is that is not the diligence that you as a leader – well, my point is that is not the diligence that you as a leader need to take. And if to do a performance appraisal well, it takes time. And particularly I find, because my head is in the numbers cloud, for me, becoming the more emotive performance structured part of that as a leader, it actually does come quite naturally. But putting it into words, you want to give somebody something that they can hold their hat on, constructive advice, whether it's on the positive or for an area of needing improvement. You really want to give them examples. And I think examples of good performance as well as examples where perhaps they need to learn from are so key.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Lorraine. The worst thing is you see people do performance appraisals and they come in and we'll have these sort of sessions and we say, okay, well, you know, how'd you rate this person? And they say, well, I rated this person, you know, a 4 out of 5. And say, okay, well, why'd you rate them a 4 out of 5? Well, they're really good and they've worked hard. And you get these sort of generalizations. And I really like what you just said, which is to say, you know, I'd rather somebody who shows up and says, well, let me give you 3 examples. You know, we had this huge project. The person did this, this, and this. Here were some specific issues they dealt with. Here's how they grew their people. You know, rather than somebody saying, well, I think the person's really good, because that just has no, there's no basis for anybody,
there's no substance
else in the
for
room
that
to talk about that.
Yeah. Well,
Look, there's one other thing I would add, Lorraine, and that is I think if people do a good ongoing job of discussing development and giving that kind of feedback, it makes the annual and semi-annual review is much, much easier.
Yes.
You know, if I give you feedback every month and or even I give you feedback at the time I see something, then when I give you your semi-annual review, nothing in there should be a surprise to you.
Right. Yes, I so much agree with you on there. And particularly in terms of if you have somebody that is on the lagging end of the spectrum, those unfortunately are elements that you have to deal with as a leader and manager of people. And there are different outcomes for that depending on the situation, circumstances, and then the performance of the individual. And very often there's something else going on in someone's life that, you know, I think as a leader you have to determine, is this activity or this performance that is currently at place out of the ordinary? And while in business you don't want to get into somebody's personal life, tragedies outside of the workplace do and will impact work environment.
Yeah, look, I agree. One of the things I expect people to work hard and I expect them to do, you know, their very best every day. But when people have personal things going on, I also think the company has a responsibility to create as much room and, you know, breathing room as possible to allow people to handle that. They come back much stronger. You know, their productivity is that much better. And frankly, I think it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, having great people allows the finance function, and that's what we're here to talk about and have been talking about, to really deliver and make a difference. And finance is so often about financial reporting. You had said in one of our earlier commentaries that one of my, and I'm going to quote you, one of my guys said to me this the other day, my team is so good, I can do anything. And your comment was, that's what you want to hear. That's just such an accolade for you as a leader.
Well, I won't take credit for it, but I was really thrilled to hear it. I mean, the last couple of weeks, as Molson Coors has worked hard on this acquisition, well, obviously it hasn't just been the last couple of weeks, it's been months, actually. But, you know, people have made the difference. When you're trying to do something very complicated, then you want to make sure you get things right and get the right sort of deal for your shareholders, then you are very much dependent on people to work hard. And, you know, working hard in long hours can be difficult, you know, in terms of you don't want people to be burnt out and not reach the right answers, etc. But I was struck by this person because he was talking specifically about the efforts that we've undertaken recently, and he felt so great about his team. And, of course, then I felt great because they're all on my team. And the more I can hear that from folks, the better. When I sit with my operational peers, there's nothing I love to hear more than they say, do you know what, if it weren't for the finance team, you know, we wouldn't have achieved this result. Or we were going to achieve 10x, but we achieved 20x because of the feedback from the finance team. And having great people is what allows you to do that. I mean, great systems and all that, of course, is very helpful. But if you don't have people who just fundamentally are outstanding, you can't hope to be very, very successful.
Well, Stuart, I so much agree with you, and this has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. But there's one final question that I must ask. We have sure. a tradition on our show to ask our guests, what is your CFO tip of the month? What is yours?
CFO tip of the month. You know what? I will tell you a people-related a tip, and that is to really ensure that people take enough personal time and have enough work-life balance. Because I just, for example, last night I got an email from one of my guys, 11:15 at night. He's been struggling through a bunch of stuff. He's worked every weekend for a whole bunch of weekends, and I'm very concerned that he's just at a point where I'm going to get a call one morning and just say, look, he's so sick, he's in the hospital, he can't move, and then I'm really going to be paralyzed. And I find that the best people on my team are people who take enough time for themselves and their families to live a great life and come into work with a ton of energy ready to drive Molson Coors brands to where they ought to go. So
wonderful
that's
tip.
My tip of the week.
Wonderful tip. Thank you so much. And Stuart Glendinning, in a formal manner, thank you so much for being a guest today, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO.
Lorraine, thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, thanks also go to our contributor, CFO.com, for our news article earlier. And thanks to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs, controllers, and interim consultants to Fortune 1000 companies. For more information about Delaney, go to DelaneyLLC.com. And thanks go to National Association of Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors, and their website is nacdonline.org. Well, this and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or you know other CFOs that would like perhaps to be a guest on the show, we want to hear from you. Please contact us via the web. There's our website, and it is info@cforadio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.